Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
And I'm Alex Astor. Good to be here.
Great to have you. We've got a lot to unpack today, diving deep into the financial world.
We really do. It feels like we're looking at a market where everything's happening at once. Policy changes, global conflict, AI's relentless march, some very strange market signals.
That's exactly it. Our mission today is, well, a comprehensive, maybe even exhaustive, look at the news, the trends, the investment ideas packed into this week's issue.
Which is
Barron's Magazine for the week of September 29th, 2025.
Right. And like you said, collision feels like the right word. You've got major policy shakeups clashing with sectors like healthcare. Then there's the ripple effect of the war in Ukraine, especially, you know, what it's doing to refined oil products, which is quite interesting.
Absolutely. And then layered on top is this AI story still dominant, still driving things, but maybe, just maybe, starting to look a little wobbly.
Definitely some wobbles. Or at least questions being asked.
And then the big picture stuff. How can the stock market be so strong while the U.S. dollar is taking such a hit? These paradoxes are popping up everywhere. It's a lot for you, the listener, to make sense of.
It really is. Okay, so where should we start? Healthcare seems like ground zero for a lot of this policy impact.
Let's do it. The cover story itself focuses on the business of mental health. And the demand picture there is, well, it's just staggering.
It really is unprecedented. You look at the Gallup numbers, 18% of U.S. adults reporting depression or treatment for it.
Right. And that's up 8 points since 2015. 8 points.
Yeah, a huge jump. And it's particularly acute if you look at younger people. That University of Michigan study found 37% of students got therapy last year.
37%.
Yeah.
And 30% on psychiatric meds. The need is just immense.
Yeah, no question. But the industry trying to meet that need, it's incredibly fragmented. You've got different models, different players, and frankly, wildly different financial outcomes.
It breaks down into roughly three areas, right?
Yeah.
You got the actual clinics, the treatment centers, the brick and mortar places.
Yep, the services side.
And the digital guys, the virtual care platforms.
Telehealth apps, that sort of thing.
And finally, the drug companies, the pharmaceuticals, and wow, talk about volatility across all three.
Oh, absolutely. Take a company like Acadia Healthcare. They run the physical facilities. Their stock got absolutely hammered, dropped from, what, $89 down to $23, all because of federal investigations into improper billing. Huge operational risk.
Ouch. Yeah.
But then just this past week, boom, it jumps 10%. Why? An activist investor, Engine Capital, takes a 3% stake.
And their argument is?
Basically, that the company is deeply undervalued despite the problems. The underlying demand for behavioral health services is so strong, they think the asset value outweighs the fines. It's a bet on the core business.
Interesting. Then you have the hybrids like LifeStance Health Group. They do both in-person and telehealth.
Right. They had a really rough time after the pandemic boom. Stock went from over $28 way down to $5. Just crushed.
Yeah, I remember that.
But they just posted their first profitable quarter since going public. So it shows the hybrid model can work, even if the initial valuation was way off. Demand is finally starting to translate into profit, for some at least.
Okay, what about the pure digital players, the ones that exploded during COVID?
Struggling, big time. Talkspace is a good example. Went public via SPAC, briefly hit $12, now it's around $2.60.
Yikes.
They even got a delisting warning from NASDAQ. Had to completely pivot their business model, shifting away from selling directly to consumers towards partnerships with employers and insurers, just to get stable revenue.
And Teladoc's BetterHelp, similar story.
Pretty much. Huge growth during the pandemic, but now facing fierce competition. And the cost to acquire customers, it's just gone through the roof in that digital ad space.
Mm.
That weakness is a big reason Teladoc's stock itself cratered, you know, from over $300 down to about $8 now.
Wow, $300 to $8. Okay, so that's services, digital. What about the pharma angle, especially the more, let's say, speculative side?
Ah, the psychedelics. This is where things get really interesting, though definitely high risk. We're talking smaller companies developing treatments using psilocybin LSD.
For depression and anxiety, right. Often for people who don't respond to standard treatments.
Exactly. Targeting treatment-resistant depression, severe anxiety. The names that pop up are companies like ATAI Life Sciences, Compass Pathways, Mind Medicine.
And ATAI has been on a tear, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Up something like 347% over the last year. It's staggering.
So the market sees real potential there, even with the regulatory hurdles.
Seems like it. You've got serious investors like Peter Thiel backing some of these. It suggests they see a real chance for disruptive new therapies, you know, something that can actually help where the old SSRIs have failed for many patients.
Yeah.
It's an admission that the current standard of care just isn't enough for everyone.
Okay, so that whole mental health space is fascinating, and it leads right into the broader healthcare sector, which, as you said, feels completely dominated by policy concerns right now.
It really does. That policy overhang is the single biggest reason healthcare stocks are lagging so badly.
The numbers don't lie. The main healthcare ETF, XLV, is down 2.5% this year, the S&P 500, up 12%.
It's a huge performance gap, and it's been frustrating healthcare investors for a couple of years now.
And the uncertainty comes from multiple directions.
Oh, yeah. It's layered. You've got the current administration cutting research spending, changing vaccine protocols. Then there are the looming Medicaid cuts everyone's watching.
And the tariff threat.
Right. The threat of a 100% tariff on imported pharmaceuticals starting October 1st, unless companies build plants here in the U.S. That forces a really tough choice between global supply chain efficiency and, well, staying on the right side of Washington.
Plus, personnel changes matter, too. The appointment of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as HHS secretary that caused ripples.
Big ripples. Oof. Firing the entire 17-member Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, ACIP, and replacing them with members known for questioning vaccine safety.
That immediately throws a wrench into things for vaccine makers, doesn't it? How do you forecast sales with that kind of regulatory noise?
Exactly. It creates uncertainty. And generalist investors,
yeah,
the ones making bank on AI and tech right now, they just don't want to deal with that kind of political risk. So they stay away, and valuations across the sector get pushed down.
So, okay, the sector's beaten down, policy risk is high. What's the investment case? What did the Barron's Healthcare Roundtable panelists say?
The core argument, and it's a crucial one, is that a lot of this policy risk is actually known now. It's arguably behind us in terms of the big potential negatives being identified.
Meaning the market has had time to digest things like Medicaid cuts, the expiration of ACA subsidies?
Precisely. The bad news, or at least the shape of it, is largely out there. So the idea is, once that's fully priced in, the focus can shift back to the fundamentals of the actual companies.
Which many panelists see as cheap.
Very cheap in many cases. Right. As one panelist put it, right now it's mostly a healthcare specialist hedge fund knife fight because the generalists are sitting on the sidelines.
So the opportunity is for investors who understand the space to pick up quality companies at bargain prices because they've been dragged down by these known policy issues.
That's the value thesis, yes. A chance to buy good assets when they're out of favor due to factors that might already be baked into the price.
Okay, let's dig into some specifics from that roundtable. What are the key themes driving investment ideas in biopharma right now? The obesity drug market has to be top of the list.
Oh, absolutely. It's still seen as a monster opportunity. Globally, they're still talking $100 billion for the industry.
And current sales are already huge.
North of $30 billion annualized already. And that's excluding the compounding pharmacies and smaller players. Huge numbers.
But there's a potential catch.
Yeah, a note of caution flagged by some analysts. They see it behaving more like a consumer market than a purely therapeutic one.
Meaning people might use the drugs episodically. Maybe stop if insurance coverage changes or costs stay high.
Exactly. Less like a chronic medication, potentially more like something people cycle on and off. That could impact long-term revenue stability.
And the competition is intense.
Fierce. Novo Nordisk was the early leader, but they hit some sales shortfalls recently, largely because Eli Lilly came on so strong with Mounjaro and Zepbound.
So what's the next battleground?
Manufacturing and delivery, that's key. Getting these drugs into pill form oral small molecules is seen as the holy grail.
Like Lilly's or a Orforglipron.
Right, the expectation is massive demand because it's a pill. Much easier to manufacture at scale compared to injectables. Scale is the real bottleneck here.
Interesting. You mentioned Metsera, which Pfizer just snapped up.
Yeah, exactly. Their compound supposedly requires much less active ingredient than Novo's oral drug. Efficiency, tolerability, ease of delivery, that's where the competition is headed, and why companies with good chemistry are such hot M&A targets.
Okay, shifting from drugs to strategy. There's this rising theme of China's biotech innovation being viewed through a national security lens now.
Yes, that's a really significant shift. It's actually impacting M&A premiums for U.S. biotechs.
How so?
Because big U.S. pharma companies are increasingly partnering with Chinese biotechs. These Chinese firms are often seen as fast followers. They can develop drugs faster, cheaper.
Putting pressure on the purely U.S.-based players.
Exactly. It lowers the premium someone might pay for a U.S. biotech if they can get a similar asset developed more cheaply via a Chinese partnership.
And Washington is paying attention.
Big time. And it's bipartisan. Both parties now see biotech not just as an industry, but as crucial for national security.
Hmm.
Think about reliance on raw materials from overseas, control over critical IP.
So that could influence future M&A? Maybe favoring deals with domestic companies?
Very possibly. It adds another layer of complexity to deal-making. Geopolitics intersecting directly with corporate strategy.
All right, let's get to the stocks. The roundtable highlighted 16 specific names. Where the policy pain might mean opportunity, maybe break them down a bit.
Sure. They kind of fall into two buckets. Larger established innovators and then smaller or mid-cap companies that look like bargains.
Okay, start with the large caps.
First up, Alanon Pharmaceuticals. They're pioneers in RNAi technology, basically silencing genes that cause disease.
What's the investment thesis there?
Two key things. One, they're successfully moving towards profitability. Two, and this is critical, they have limited exposure to the Inflation Reduction Act's drug pricing rules.
Because their main drug has an orphan drug exemption.
Exactly. That shields them from Medicare price negotiations, which is a huge overhang for many other drug companies. It makes their valuation cleaner. Analysts estimate their core TTR franchise alone is worth around $365 a share, suggesting the stock's undervalued based just on that.
Okay, who else?
Vertex Pharmaceuticals. They're dominant in cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
After a pullback, they look interesting. The obvious driver is their CF franchise. But the overlooked part is their move into kidney and autoimmune diseases through the Alpine acquisition.
A whole new growth area.
Potentially a $20 billion market opportunity with a drug called Povatacept. It gives them a major growth path beyond CF.
Got it. Then there's Teva.
Yeah, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries. It's trading like it's distressed maybe 7 times forward earnings, which is incredibly cheap for large cap pharma.
But the risks are similar to peers.
Largely, yes. The bet is that as their branded biotech business grows over the next few years, you could see 30-40% upside, especially if those policy risks are already reflected in that super low multiple.
What about medical devices?
Edwards Life Sciences. They're the leader in TAVR that's minimally invasive, aortic valve replacement. The stock's been out of favor lately.
Uh-huh.
But they're strategically expanding into mitral and tricuspid valve replacement. Moving into these newer, faster-growing heart valve markets could really re-energize their growth story.
And the last large cap pick.
CVS Health. This one's pitched as a managed care recovery play. It's trading at only about 8 times estimated earnings, which is a steep discount.
Why so cheap?
The Aetna insurance part of the business has been struggling. New management is laser-focused on improving margins there. If they succeed, there's significant operational upside potential.
Okay, that covers the bigger names. What about the small and mid-cap bargains? Potentially higher risk, higher reward.
Definitely. This is where you find companies with really innovative tech platforms or strong M&A potential.
Point light.
Denali Therapeutics. They're nearing potential approval for their first drug, for Hunter syndrome. But the real story isn't just that drug.
It's the platform.
Exactly. Their core technology is designed to get drugs across the blood-brain barrier. That has huge implications for much bigger diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. Hunter syndrome is just a proof of concept. The platform is the long-term prize.
Interesting. What else?
Enliven Therapeutics. Targeted oncology, they have a drug for chronic myeloid leukemia, CML, entering phase 3. They're behind Novartis's drug, but their profile looks strong.
M&A potential there.
Definitely. A promising oncology asset like that makes them a pretty obvious takeout target for bigger pharma companies looking to bolster their cancer pipelines.
Okay. Centessa Pharmaceuticals.
They had a nice run recently, but still considered a buy. They're focused on narcolepsy, developing a new class of drugs called orexin agonists. Their lead candidate, ORX750, is seen as potentially best-in-class for severe narcolepsy. High unmet need there.
And Metsera, the one Pfizer just bought, that highlights the M&A angle.
Perfectly. It shows how fast things are moving, especially in hot areas like obesity. Companies with promising assets are getting snapped up quickly.
So in that context, Roivant Sciences was also mentioned.
Right. Seen as having an undervalued portfolio. They just had positive phase 3 results for a drug called brepocitinib in inflammatory diseases. Plus, and this is key for investors worried about risk.
They have cash.
Over $4 billion in net cash. That gives them a ton of financial flexibility to fund their pipeline and ride out market volatility. Very appealing in this environment.
Makes sense. Keep going.
Oruka Therapeutics. They're working on treatments for psoriasis, specifically ultra-long-acting ones. Phase 2 results expected in 2026.
What's the potential upside?
If they can show better efficacy and maybe allow for just annual dosing, that would be a huge win for patient convenience and could command a premium price. Big potential, but further out.
Okay. New Amsterdam Pharma.
Treating high LDL cholesterol. Trading cheaply. Data looks good so far. They're waiting on cardiovascular outcome results. That would be the big catalyst for broader use. Plus, they have another asset being looked at for early onset Alzheimer's, another potential future driver.
Vaxcyte sounds like another beaten down story.
Very much so. Was a $12 billion company, now around $4 billion market cap. Their pneumococcal vaccine data in adults looks solid, targeting a $1 billion plus market.
So why the drop?
Seems partly linked to that political noise around vaccines and RFK Jr.'s appointment. The thinking is, if that uncertainty clears, the stock could see a nice rebound, maybe 30% or so.
And finally, a couple of device and diagnostic plays.
Right. ICU Medical makes medical devices. Down 23% this year, hit hard by tariffs. But the panelists see the underlying business momentum improving. And Quidelvo, they sell diagnostic tests, trading at an attractive valuation 7x expected 2025 EBITDA right before the winter respiratory virus season kicks in. Good seasonal timing.
Wow, that's a lot of names. So the overall outlook from the panel, more clarity coming.
The hope is more certainty by 2026. Maybe broader economic factors like potential rate cuts start to outweigh the specific regulatory worries. And definitely an expectation of a big wave of M&A finally hitting the sector, which should benefit many of these smaller, undervalued companies.
Okay, a huge amount to digest on the healthcare front, driven so much by domestic policy. Let's broaden the scope now. You mentioned geopolitical conflict impact in markets. Mm-hmm. How does the Ukraine war fit in?
Right. So shifting from Washington policy to global conflict, the focus here is on the oil market, but maybe not in the way people expect.
It's not just about sanctions anymore.
No. The key disruption now is these Ukrainian drone attacks hitting Russian refineries. They've reportedly knocked out at least 1.5 million barrels per day of refining capacity. That's like 30% of Russia's total. It's significant.
Okay. So less Russian refining capacity. What does that do to prices?
Here's the weird part. Crude oil prices themselves, not really benefiting, actually down 8% year to date.
Why?
Because the bottleneck isn't crude supply, it's turning that crude into usable products like gasoline and diesel. If the refineries are damaged, you can't process the oil. So prices for refined products are soaring.
Ah, so it's the refiners, especially outside Russia, who benefit.
Exactly. U.S. refiners are cleaning up. Companies like Valero Energy up 17% in just a month. Marathon Petroleum up 13%. They're running their refineries flat out, like 94% capacity, way higher than usual for the fall season to capture these massive margins.
So Marathon is the favored play.
Yeah, analysts like Marathon. It trades at a reasonable 14x expected 2026 earnings. And they're just really good at converting those high refining margins, the crack spreads, into cash flow for shareholders.
Got it. So war impacts oil products, policy impacts healthcare. Let's talk about another policy angle. The report on the current administration exerting unusual control over private companies.
Yeah, this was a striking piece, describing it as maybe the biggest grab for private sector control by the White House outside of a major crisis.
And it involves direct influence, quid pro quos almost,
correct.
White House help in exchange for corporate alignment.
That's the allegation. What's really strange, though, is the market reaction. You'd think shareholders would hate this kind of political interference risk.
But they don't.
Largely, no. The article points out that for 4 out of the 6 companies mentioned where this happened, the stock actually went up.
Yeah, how does that work? What are the examples?
The clearest one is probably rare earth miners. MP Materials saw its stock double after news broke that the government was getting involved, with the Department of Defense buying a 15% stake to secure critical mineral supplies.
So the promise of government contracts or subsidies outweighs the control risk.
Seems that way. Same with Intel. Stock rose 24% after the government took a 10% stake, right after there was pressure on the CEO to step down. It feels very much like state-directed capitalism.
And the U.S. Steel deal.
Right. When Nippon Steel got approval to buy U.S. Steel, the White House apparently retained veto power over certain decisions. And they used it. They blocked Nippon from idling a plant in Illinois. The stated reason. Prioritizing domestic capacity over what Nippon called a sensible business decision.
So jobs and capacity over corporate efficiency.
That appears to be the White House calculus. Mm. They even said they're not focused on the internal rate of return for shareholders, but on ensuring taxpayers' benefit and domestic capacity is maintained. It's a very different objective function.
Were there negative examples?
Yes. NVIDIA and AMD shares fell when the White House demanded 15% of their China chip sales revenue be put towards U.S. supply chain security. So it cut both ways for shareholders.
Okay, so U.S. policy impacting U.S. companies. Let's shift again globally. India's market has been struggling. Why?
Yeah, India's really lagged the broader emerging markets recently. Mm. The main India ETF, the iShares MSCI one, fell 10% over the past year, while global EM was up nearly 20%. That's a big divergence.
What's holding it back?
A couple of things. Headwinds, like the U.S. imposing a 50% tariff on some exports, hurt. Domestically, the Modi government tightened spending, and the central bank kept interest rates high, 6.5%, trying to fight inflation. That slowed things down.
But there's another factor, the AI factor.
Right. Global investors are just obsessed with AI right now.
Yeah.
And India, well, it doesn't have a lot of the big AI hardware or software plays.
Like Taiwan, South Korea, or China do.
Yeah, exactly. Capital flowed heavily into those markets.
Yeah.
Hong Kong shares soared 35%.
Mm.
India got left behind because, as one fund manager bluntly put it, it's still in the industrial age compared to the AI boom elsewhere in Asia, suffering from AI envy, basically.
But is there a longer-term case for India?
Definitely. The headwinds are easing somewhat. The central bank cut rates to 5.5%. They simplified the goods and services tax, GST. And crucially, after the market correction, India's valuations look much more reasonable, kind of in line with the U.S. now.
But with much faster growth potential.
Expected to grow maybe four times faster than the U.S. through 2030. So you get that high growth potential at a valuation that's no longer sky high. That's a long-term opportunity.
So where are analysts suggesting investors look in India?
They like the private banks, HDFC Bank, ICICI Bank. They benefit directly from strong credit growth as the economy expands.
Uh-huh.
And also e-commerce plays like Eternal, which is the parent company of Zomato. They're riding that wave of instant commerce, 10-minute delivery of groceries and stuff, which is booming in Indian cities.
Okay, so India missing the AI wave. That's a perfect segue back to the U.S., where AI is still the dominant theme, even with those wobbles we mentioned.
Right. India's struggles just highlight how much capital and attention is focused squarely on AI here. And the first piece of AI news this week is a real milestone.
The CFA exam.
Yeah. AI basically aced the CFA Level 3 exam.
Which is notoriously difficult, right? Lots of essays, requires judgment.
Exactly. It was seen as a bastion of human analytical skill.
Mm-hmm.
Just last year, AI models bombed the essay portions. But a new study tested 23 large language models.
Bam.
They passed easily, in minutes. OpenAI's O4 mini model scored almost 80%. It shows incredibly rapid progress in AI's ability to handle complex qualitative tasks.
So are human financial analysts obsolete?
Not yet, probably. You still need human judgment for really novel, complex situations. But it definitely means AI is going to automate the lower level, more routine analytical tasks very, very quickly.
And that could have weird side effects, like younger analysts not learning the basics.
That's the concern. The analogy used was giving elementary kids calculators too early. If AI does all the grunt work of data gathering and basic modeling, how do junior professionals develop those foundational synthesis skills they need later? It's a real question for the industry.
Okay, so AI is getting smarter, but the market is showing signs of an AI spending wobble.
Yeah, there are definitely some jitters about the sheer amount of money being poured into AI infrastructure.
Like the hard drive companies, Seagate, Western Digital.
Exactly. These stocks were basically left for dead a few years ago now. There are waiting lists nearly a year long for their high-capacity drives because AI needs so much storage. It's a wild swing.
And the overall spending projections are massive.
Astronomical. The hyperscalers, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Meta, their AI-related investments are projected to compound at 30% a year, hitting $500 billion by 2027.
Wow, $500 billion.
Yeah. And that spending fuels booms in related industries. Like nuclear power estimates suggest they'll need $3 trillion in new investment by 2050 just to generate the electricity AI data centers will consume.
Hmm.
It's an infrastructure build-out on a scale we haven't seen in decades.
But that kind of spending raises bubble fears, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You hear echoes of the late 90s dot-com bubble. David Einhorn, the hedge fund manager, explicitly warned about this company spending way too fast, potentially creating a glut like the dark fiber boom back then, where telecom companies laid way more fiber optic cable than was actually needed.
Leading to huge losses when the demand didn't materialize as expected.
Precisely. That's the fear.
Is there a counterargument that the spending isn't that crazy?
Yeah, the more moderate view, like from Barclays, says don't panic yet. They argue the hyperscalers are mostly funding this expansion from their own massive cash flows, not necessarily debt. And their calculations suggest that even if data center investments suddenly drop 20%, it would only knock about 3-4% off S&P 500 earnings estimates. A hit, yes, but maybe not catastrophic for the overall market.
And we had that mini stress test back in January, right? The DeepSeek scare.
Perfect example. A free Chinese chatbot looked like it could rival ChatGPT. NVIDIA plunged 17% in a day panic.
But the broad market.
The S&P 500 only fell about 1.5%. Investors just rotated quickly out of the AI leaders and into value and quality stocks. It showed some underlying resilience, some ability to absorb a shock to the AI darlings.
Okay. Speaking of the biggest darling, NVIDIA, they have this unique strategy for dealing with their mountain of cash, right? This circular financing idea.
Yeah, it's fascinating and maybe unprecedented. NVIDIA generated $112 billion in free cash flow in just 6 quarters. They're sitting on $57 billion in cash and investments.
And they can't just buy competitors because of regulations.
Right. Regulators likely wouldn't approve huge M&A deals. So they've become this sort of investor of last resort for the AI ecosystem. They backstop the boom, and in doing so, create guaranteed customers for their own chips.
The CoreWeave example illustrates this.
Perfectly. CoreWeave was a small cloud provider. NVIDIA helped them grow, partly by giving them early access to the latest servers, the hardware everyone else is desperate for. CoreWeave is now valued at $80 billion.
And the recent deal?
NVIDIA committed to buy any excess data center capacity. CoreWeave builds a $6.3 billion commitment. That gives lenders the confidence to loan CoreWeave money to expand.
So CoreWeave can buy more NVIDIA chips.
Exactly. It's circular. Plus, NVIDIA owns about 5% of CoreWeave's stock. They fuel their customers' growth and benefit from it directly.
And the OpenAI deal sounds even bigger.
Staggering scale. NVIDIA committing up to $100 billion to help OpenAI build massive new data centers. Again, that investment comes right back to NVIDIA as OpenAI buys their equipment.
NVIDIA gets stock and OpenAI out of it.
Effectively, yes. They help fund the build-out, guarantee OpenAI uses their gear, and get equity in the leading AI startup, arguably for very little net cash outlay. It's a brilliant way to deploy capital and lock in market share.
Okay, so NVIDIA's strategy is clear. But what about the companies getting hurt by the AI narrative, the so-called AI losers? Is there an opportunity there?
Behrens argues yes. There's definitely an AI hangover effect. While the Magnificent Seven soar, lots of other software and data companies are struggling.
Because the market fears AI will just replicate what they do.
That's the narrative, that generative AI will make their products obsolete, and that fear is creating some potentially deep discounts.
So who are the contrarian picks?
Companies like ServiceNow, down 10% this year. The argument is customers aren't going to rip out complex ServiceNow systems just because ChatGPT exists. They'll integrate AI into those existing workflows. Same logic applies to Salesforce.
Makes sense. Any others?
Sage Group, the UK accounting software company. Looks cheap, 23 times 2026 earnings, a big discount to Intuit. The thesis is similar. Accounting is complex, regulated. Businesses will stick with trusted platforms.
What about data providers? Like FactSet, they seem directly threatened.
Yeah, FactSet Research Systems got hammered, down 40% this year, trading at a 15-year low PE multiple of 16. The fear is definitely that generative AI can scrape and synthesize financial data much more cheaply.
But there's a counter-argument.
The UBS analyst quoted argue the fears are overblown. Their point is that finance is heavily regulated. You need auditable, compliant data sources. That requirement will slow down the adoption of less transparent generative AI tools, keeping FactSet embedded in workflows for a long time. Hmm. Regulatory inertia as a moat.
Interesting. And even low-tech companies can get an AI boost.
Apparently so. ABM Industries, the facilities management company, cleaning, maintenance, engineering, trades cheaply at 12 times 2025 earnings.
How does AI help them?
They might use AI internally for cost cutting, maybe robotics, maybe lead generation. But the core argument from their CEO is that AI won't disintermediate their business because it's fundamentally people-led. You still need humans to fix the plumbing or clean the building. So they benefit from AI efficiency without the existential competitive risk.
Okay, that brings us nicely from specific stocks to the bigger market picture, the psychology, and this idea of pity the poor money manager. What's that about?
It's one of the most revealing parts of the magazine, I thought. It tackles this paradox. Many professional money managers privately think stocks are irrationally high, way overvalued.
But they don't sell.
They feel they can't. Or at least it's incredibly risky for their careers if they do.
Why?
Because if they shift to cash and the market keeps going up, maybe fueled by AI hype or policy hopes, their clients might pull their money out, investor redemptions. Their own income is tied to the size of the fund they manage, not necessarily beating the market by being cautious. Selling and being wrong is potentially career suicide.
The Michael Burry lesson. from The Big Short.
Exactly. He was right about subprime mortgages in 2005, but he almost lost his fund because his investors couldn't stand missing out on the stock market gains while he was waiting for the crash. They pulled their money.
So the practical lesson for managers is stay invested, even if you're nervous, to protect your assets under management and your income stream.
Pretty much. It helps explain why prices can stay at these giddy highs even when sophisticated players are skeptical. They're incentivized to ride the wave, maybe just hope for the best. Contrast that with someone like Warren Buffett,
who has permanent capital at Berkshire Hathaway.
Right. And he's sitting on a record $339.8 billion in cash and treasuries, signaling his skepticism loud and clear. But most managers don't have that luxury.
So the pros are trapped, but average investors are being encouraged to jump into even riskier areas, like private investing.
Yeah, it's another strange disconnect. There's this big push for democratization of alternatives. Private equity, venture capital, private debt, making them available to smaller retail investors.
Even while some big institutions, like Yale's endowment, are reportedly selling off billions in alternatives.
Exactly. Yale, which basically pioneered institutional investing in alternatives, is pulling back $3 billion. That should maybe give retail investors pause.
And the reality for average folks investing in private markets is tough.
Very tough, according to the writer's personal experience shared in the article. Key risks are illiquidity. Your money is locked up for years, maybe a decade or more. Opacity getting information can be hard, sometimes just a tax form once a year.
And the recorded returns might not be what they seem.
Right. The article points out that headline returns often don't reflect the actual experience of most investors in a fund. The personal anecdote was telling. Bad investments often went to zero or just returned nothing after years. Good ones could be spectacular, like one up 70x after 8 years. But others in the same batch were total losses. It's a very different ballgame than public markets.
Okay, let's tackle the biggest disconnect mentioned. Stocks up, dollar down. What's going on there?
It's a real head-scratcher on the surface. S&P 500 up 12% this year, looking strong. But the U.S. dollar, down 9%. That's its biggest slide since 1973.
Why the divergence?
It seems to be driven by two different investor groups looking at two different things.
Yeah.
U.S. investors, they're bullish on the domestic economy, the AI boom, corporate earnings. They're buying U.S. stocks.
But non-U.S. investors,
they're looking at the bigger U.S. macro picture and getting nervous. They see the trade tariffs, the huge public debt, potential threats to the Federal Reserve's independence, and the expectation that the Fed will cut rates soon. All of which are bearish for the dollar as a currency.
So U.S. investors focus on companies, global investors focus on the country's finances and policies.
That seems to be the dynamic. And that weak dollar, it's actually a hidden tailwind for U.S. stocks.
Because multinationals earn profits overseas.
Exactly. About 40% of S&P 500 revenues come from abroad. When the dollar is weak, those foreign earnings translate back into more dollars on the income statement. It boosts reported profits.
What's the outlook for the dollar? More weakness.
Opinions are split. Morgan Stanley thinks it could fall another 10% by the end of 2026, citing structural issues. Goldman Sachs disagrees. They think the recent slide is just temporary, and the dollar's long-term bull market remains intact because it's still the world's preferred store of value in uncertain times.
And the administration's view, Trump likes a weaker dollar.
He said he does, yeah. Good for exports, good for tourism, though he acknowledges it's also good for inflation, which is the downside.
This brings us back to politics influencing markets. There's even a section suggesting investors should follow the trust Trump market force.
It's a provocative argument, definitely. The thesis is that the former president sees the stock market as a direct reflection on his presidency and will actively push for policies like lower interest rates to boost it.
Arguing he already won against the Fed earlier this year.
That's part of the argument, yeah, that he pushed the Fed towards cutting rates, challenging the old don't fight the Fed mantra.
Is there evidence cited?
The article notes that since Trump posted on social media on April 7th telling people not to be panickins, the S&P 500 is up 31%.
Correlation, not necessarily causation, but...
Right. But the suggested strategy to play this belief is a bullish option spread on the small-cap Russell 2000 ETF, IWM. It's up 34% since that same date. It's basically a bet that political will continues to drive stocks higher and rates lower.
Wow. Okay, let's pivot from the big picture back to some specific company deep dives. What about retail resilience? O'Reilly Automotive.
Yeah, O'Reilly keeps commanding a premium valuation 35 times earnings, compared to AutoZone at 27x. Why?
Do-it-yourself repairs.
That's a big part of it. People are keeping cars longer, fixing them themselves, especially when financing new cars is expensive. But O'Reilly's real edge is logistics.
How so?
Their distribution network is apparently incredible. Some stores get restocked 6 to 8 times a day. Average delivery time from warehouse to store is under 20 minutes.
That's fast. So they can carry less inventory but still have the part you need.
Exactly. It's super efficient. Allows them to forecast sales growth around 6% annually for the next couple of years, better than competitors. Tariffs aren't expected to slow them down much either.
Okay, from fixing cars to a much more serious consumer issue, the gambling helpline crisis.
Yeah, a really concerning story. Calls to 1-800-GAMBLER have exploded nearly 4 times the level in 2022.
Driven by the legalization and mainstreaming of sports betting.
Seems directly linked. As gambling becomes more accessible, addiction rates rise. Even the NFL has acknowledged the issue, providing grants for problem gambling services.
But there's a fight over control of the helpline number itself.
Right. The National Council on Problem Gambling, which had partnered with the industry and set national standards, just lost control of the 1-800 number in court. It reverts back to the New Jersey nonprofit that originally launched it decades ago.
What's the conflict about?
It seems to be about centralization versus local control. The National Council enforced universal standards, centralized data, text and chat functions, and even pushed back against states that didn't comply. The National Council warns the transition could cause the network to fall apart temporarily. The New Jersey group promises no lapse. The risk is that people needing help might face confusion or inconsistent service during this handover.
Okay. Shifting to retirement, concierge medicine is getting a boost.
Potentially, yes. Concierge medicine is that model where patients pay an annual fee anywhere from $1,000 to $30,000 for enhanced access, 247 care, help coordinating specialists, less administrative hassle.
Focused on convenience and service.
Entirely. And policy might help it grow. Things like Medicaid cuts could push more doctors out of the traditional insurance system, making private pay models like concierge more appealing to them.
And there's a new tax break coming.
Big news here. Starting next year, you'll be able to use your health savings account, HSA funds, to pay the membership fees for certain direct primary care practices.
Up to a limit.
Up to $150 a month for individuals, $300 for families. But the practice has to meet strict criteria, like not offering major procedures.
Does it actually improve health outcomes?
The evidence on that is limited, actually. Patients love the experience. It feels more personal, less rushed. But whether it leads to measurably better health is unclear. It's really about paying for convenience and peace of mind, if you can afford it.
Got it. Okay, one last deep dive for income investors. Shareholder yield versus dividend yield.
Yeah, this is important for income seekers. The argument is that simple dividend yield doesn't tell the whole story. Shareholder yield is a better metric.
Because it includes
dividends plus stock buybacks plus debt paydowns. It's a measure of the total capital being returned to shareholders, not just the dividend check.
The GM example was stark.
Right. General Motors has a tiny 1% dividend yield, but they bought back shares worth 14% of the market cap. Add it up, and you get a 15% shareholder yield. Huge difference.
But there's a catch with GM.
Yeah. They borrowed money to fund those buybacks, which adds risk. You want companies covering those payouts from actual net income.
So Barron's highlighted 10 stocks with high shareholder yields and covered payouts.
Exactly. The list included names like Comcast, Molson Coors, General Mills, Kraft Heinz, HP, Devon Energy, EOG Resources, Lennar, Halliburton, and Eastman Chemical.
And how does that group look overall?
Pretty compelling on the surface. They average a 9% shareholder yield, triple the S&P 500's average. And they trade cheaply, around 10 times estimated 2026 earnings versus 22x for the S&P.
But there's always a but.
They've performed terribly from a price perspective. The group is down 14% year-to-date, while the S&P is up 13%. Just shows how completely investors are fixated on AI and growth, ignoring this kind of traditional value and yield.
A huge disconnect. Okay, let's quickly run through some final corporate moves and insider signals from the week. Analyst actions.
Worthington Enterprises got a buy rating, $74 target.
Yeah.
Analysts like the prospect of double-digit EBITDA growth, driven by operational improvements and new products in their manufacturing businesses.
And Micron Technology. Still positive sentiment there.
Very positive. $200 price target. Guidance is better than expected. The key is tight supply in memory chips, which is supporting strong pricing into 2026. And crucially, their product mix is shifting fast towards the high-margin stuff needed for AI HBM HCD IMs. That's where the money is.
What about activist investors?
Bit of drama to start Surgical. An activist fund, Yungi Capital, took a 5% stake and is publicly opposing the proposed 28-share takeover by Alcon. They think the company is worth much more. Could be a fight brewing there.
And some selling by big holders.
Yeah, ValueAct trimmed its stake in Insight Enterprises, though they still own almost 8%. And Access Industries sold a huge chunk of Open Door Technologies, 25 million shares, after the stock went absolutely vertical this year, up over 400%. Classic profit-taking.
Finally, insider trading signals. Anything noteworthy?
Two examples stood out. An executive at Strategy, formerly MicroStrategy, the big Bitcoin holder, sold $3.6 million worth of stock just days before Bitcoin's price slumped. He'd exercised options around $40 and sold near $356. Very well-timed, given the company is basically a leveraged bet on Bitcoin.
Bet at Tesla.
A senior VP, Tom Zhu, sold about $7.3 million worth of stock. But that was totally overshadowed because Elon Musk bought $1 billion worth the very next day. So Musk's buying drowned out the executive selling signal.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground. Let's try to synthesize. What's the core tension you see in the market this week based on Barron's?
It really feels like this tug of war. On one side, you have all this policy-driven disruption in healthcare and trade, the government influencing companies. That's creating volatility, uncertainty, but also potentially deep value opportunities in beaten down areas.
And on the other side?
You have the AI juggernaut. Still consuming immense capital, still driving the market's overall gains, even as questions about the sustainability of the spending bubble up. It's policy risk versus tech momentum.
And maybe the most critical long-term risk flag relates back to policy, specifically the Federal Reserve.
I think so. The focus on Governor Steven Marin's comments was telling. He's seen as the administration's key appointment to the Fed.
And he did a complete U-turn on interest rates.
Pretty much. In 2024, he was arguing rates were too low. Now, suddenly, he's arguing they're too high. He's making a case that things like lower immigration and tariffs have reduced the neutral interest rate Reichstag.
The rate that neither boosts nor slows the economy.
Right. If the Fed starts adjusting its view of Reichstag based on factors like that, potentially to justify lower rates, It raises serious questions about whether policy is truly data dependent anymore or if it's becoming politically influenced.
A 180-degree turn in less than a year is pretty stark.
It is. And it fuels worries about Fed independence. If investors start to believe the Fed's decisions are being dictated by politics rather than objective economic analysis, That's a huge negative signal. It undermines the credibility that markets rely on, potentially hitting the dollar, bonds, stocks, everything.
So that really is the final provocative thought for you, the listener, isn't it?
I think so. If Washington policy becomes the primary driver influencing corporate actions, maybe even dictating central bank targets, how reliable are any of our traditional economic forecasts or valuation models? Does analyzing fundamentals become less important than analyzing political wins?
A challenging question as we head into the rest of the year. Thank you for guiding us through that complex landscape.
My pleasure. Always fascinating.
And thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive. We'll talk to you next time.